Good afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. The time is 1:04 p.m. Members present at this time, Representative Chris Tuck, Representative Sarah Hannon, Representative Dave Tellerico, Representative George Rauscher, Representative Sarah Rasmussen, Vice Chair Representative Greyer Hopkins, Co-Chair Representative John Lincoln, and myself, Representative Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. We would appreciate if you would silence your cell phones at this time. As we do our business, we want to thank our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast. Thank you, Ms. Tillinghast, for your help. And our LIO moderator, Brett Collins. Thank you for your help today. Welcome to Representative Sponholz, who just joined us. We have a couple of items on the calendar today. We flip-flopped the hearings on HB 151 and 138. So you'll notice HB 151 bill hearing is canceled. We did that last Friday. Today we have House Bill 240, the first hearing of the bill related to regulating PFAS chemicals, and then continuation of amendments on House Bill 138, and we'll see how far we get with that. We're going to try to do about an hour on each, and so it's the first hearing of 240, so we know we'll have that one back before us, and then again, we'll see how much time and how far we get with the second part on that work. So the first order of business is House Bill 240. This is by Representative Hannon, so if we could please have Representative Hannon and her staff, Mr. Clark, join us at the front table.
Thank you, Chair Tarr. Thank you, Chair Lincoln. Thank you, members of the committee. I am hoping that we could adopt the work draft.
Yes, I was just going to let you put yourselves on the record if you wanted to, and then we would do that.
I'm Representative Sarah Hannon, House District 33. This is my Chief of Staff, Tim Clark.
Okay. Thank you and welcome.
Madam Chair, I would like to move the committee substitute for House Bill 240, Version M, Work Draft 31-LS1509/M as the working document.
And I'm going to object just for purposes of discussion. And again, for anyone watching, we're adopting a committee substitute, but it is the first hearing of this bill, so we haven't previously heard any other version. Thank you.
Correct. And again, I'm Sarah Hannon, House District 33. The committee substitute for House Bill 240 is a bill to address drinking water standards that have been exposed to PFAS, perfluoroalkali, polyfluoroalkali substance that I'm going to just refer to as PFAS. And you will find that we are addressing seven PFAS-related chemicals in this bill. In Alaska, PFAS exposure has mostly been linked to firefighting foam that has been used at both airports across Alaska and in the oil and gas industry. It's a fairly amazing set of chemical compounds that have the ability to strangle out fires in highly flammable, high-intensity fires like an oil field fire. It's also a strange set of chemicals that are renowned for their inability to decompose, so forever chemicals. That's part of the reason that they're very good at starving fires. They starve out the oxygen. It is also the danger that causes them to linger in water, basically in perpetuity. They do not break down. PFAS chemicals have been linked over the last 40 years to low birth rates, thyroid disease, and a variety of cancers, testicular, kidney, and pancreatic cancers in particular. PFAS contamination is in the water tables of many Alaskan communities as we've started to test over the last handful of years. Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation has declared that PFAS is a hazardous substance. We did that several years ago. House Bill 240 attempts to establish the standard that we will regulate those for safe water drinking. The Department of Environmental Conservation currently is deferring to EPA levels, and we don't think that keeps Alaska's drinking water safe enough. The bill uses a set of standards that was developed by the Michigan PFAS Action Response Team. Michigan happens to be a state both with lots of risk areas and a high academic interest, and so the state of Michigan has been one of the places where a lot of research has been done on PFAS contamination from both industrial applications and the firefighting foams that most Alaskan communities have been exposed to for their pollution sources. The bill ensures that once communities have been contaminated, the polluter will pay for an alternative drinking water source. And those resolutions for communities are widely varied, as the Alaskan drinking water systems are widely varied. For some communities, that'll be alternative water systems. Some will be extending current water systems to meet household users, and some may need to deal with new filtration systems. The polluter will also be required to pay for 3 years of voluntary blood testing for people who've been exposed, either through polluted water or through their work as firefighters using them in applications. House Bill 240 will stop PFAS from being used in Alaska. It'll prohibit their use as soon as it is no longer required by the federal government. We do have a number of federal agencies that there is a carve-out for. The Coast Guard says they will continue to comply with the federal law on application of the firefighting foam, no matter what the state says, and so we've created a carve-out in the law so they would not be held for that. There's also a carve-out in the bill. That's what the committee substitute does. It does these two carve-outs that would allow the oil and gas industry to continue to use it as their prime firefighting response foam. There does not seem to be, even by the fire marshal standards, an adequate response to use in oil and gas fires. House Bill 240 addresses the matter of liability. If you were responsible for a fire that resulted in PFAS foam having to be applied, the fire ignition is the point of liability versus the fire department who's used PFAS foams to put out your fire. A person who has used PFAS foam to extinguish is not liable. This bill attempts to not change any liability. The polluter will continue to pay, but if you are a fire department responding to a fire that you are allowed to use PFAS foam, you would not be held as liable for using it when it is. You've responded to an oil gas fire. You've used what is legally able to be used, so you're not liable as a fire department for applying that. And finally, the bill requires DEC to come up with a disposal and accept up to 25 gallons of PFAS foam for disposal, because across Alaska we have many fire departments who have received, I just lost the term for it, red cart, there's another word in there. The state of Alaska has shared with very many small communities firefighting equipment that contains PFAS foam, and this bill would address that DEC would be required to accept that foam back for safe disposal and not charge the communities that are returning that foam to the state. And that is the simplest and about the technical level of expertise I have on the chemicals that make up PFAS.
Thank you, Representative Hannon. And before we go to the sectional by Mr. Clark, Representative Rauscher had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, you made a statement that the EPA levels, that those aren't good enough. And I was just wondering if you could fully explain that to us.
The EPA is currently using standards that we don't think meet safe water standards for drinking.
Is there any more through the chair? Can you explain that a little better or not? I don't understand, I guess.
They are measured. There are actually a couple of technical experts that are with us today that I think would be better prepared to address the difference between the EPA standards and the standards that we're asking for.
Okay, and to return one more follow-up?
Mm-hmm, sure.
You went through a list of people who would not be held harmless, or not be held harmless.
Not so be held liable.
I guess what I was wanting to know is who actually is then in this bill.
So currently, for instance, fire departments have been testing with it. Mm-hmm. So annually just practicing. This bill would say, don't do that. If you've got a fire that's an oil, a double tanker distributing, and you've got a tanker fire on a highway, and your fire department has responded to that tanker fire that is gas and used it, that fire department is not liable, that they are responding to a fire and using the foam that they need to put out that oil fire from those tanker trucks. But if they just tested with it, they would be liable.
I see. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay. Any Representative Sponholz?
Yeah. Thank you. Through the chair, could you describe how the Michigan PFAS Action Response Team arrived on their levels and why it is that you chose to go with those levels rather than those that the EPA has?
And there are some technical experts. I believe Mr. Bellot could address that. But the seven PFAS compounds that we're using in the bill and those levels from the Michigan are the seven that have the most scientific research that's been done over the last 20 years for disease link causation and have set their levels at it. There are many more PFAS compounds. Those are the seven that the peer-reviewed science have the most conclusive data on. And that's why we've narrowed it to that, and that's where Michigan's come from.
Yeah, I guess just to clarify, it's because there was, what was it about the Michigan team's sort of composition or their strategy that led to the identification of these seven?
I'm going to defer to my staff.
All right, thank you.
For the record, this is Tim Clark, staff to Representative Hannon. I think you might be referring to what is known as the State of Michigan PFAS Action Response Team. Mm-hmm. And the response team itself assembled a working group of experts to analyze the different forms of PFAS that have had the most study in terms of the risks to health that they present. And after a very rigorous and thorough analysis, they brought these levels that exist in this bill to the PFAS Action Response Team in Michigan. And we felt, in terms of the research that's been done, that they are the most prudent levels that have been developed to date.
Mm-hmm. And when did they produce the recommendations? I know that this is the reason I'm asking is I'm trying to understand how this fits within sort of like the landscape of different options that are out there, and also sort of what was the timing on this report, because what we're learning is we're learning there's new science and information and things are changing in this area. And so I'm trying, was this a fairly recent product? How long did it take them to get there? That kind of thing.
Madam Chair, Representative Sponholz, those recommendations, these issues are moving very quickly because of the degree to which these contaminations are being found at a rapid pace across the United States. The action response team in Michigan was set up only within the last couple of years, and the working group's recommendations on these levels, these maximum allowable levels, were only reported to the response team in the summer of 2019. Okay. So it's very recent. It is it is about as relevant in terms of recent research as can be found. So we've gone with it.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair. I'm just curious as to why we would want to put the PFAS levels in statute, given that DEC has already been statutorily designated the authority from the legislature to determine the levels. And I think that that's exemplified in the recent sulfalane with the Fairbanks. Is that the right language? Okay. That case in Fairbanks, and it just concerns me that we're possibly setting a dangerous precedent.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon. My constituents and I have been dissatisfied with the level that DEC has taken as an action level to treat and provide remedy for communities. And that's why we are seeking a statute that sets a standard that we believe provides safe drinking water.
Quick follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So given that we know that this is a very quickly evolving situation, is there any concern that the amount of time it takes to change statute could be problematic in the future when regulation can be changed much easier?
Through the chair, when I assumed, actually before I assumed office and was sworn in the fall of 2018, was the first time I had ever heard about PFAS and was told it was a carryover and ongoing issue from the incumbent. And the community in my district that had been tested and was getting some resolution was Gustavus. By the time we were sworn in January, other communities across the state who had the same levels of PFAS compounds being tested were no longer qualifying for action because DEC had gone from using a cumulative total of adding 6 different compounds to get a level to take action to 2. So even though other communities had the same level of toxicity in their drinking water, without statutory guidance and direction, DEC was defaulting to the EPA levels, which were using 2 compounds instead of 6. Even through months of dialogue about the fact that other communities, besides my community of Gustavus, had same levels of toxicity, they were not going to get remediation. And so this was one of those dark and sort of sad things that by Gustavus being one of the earliest communities that we tested for it and used a standard of 6 compounds to come up with the number of action, Gustavus was getting some remedy that's not actually satisfactory to the community, but the fact that DEC acknowledged there was toxic water there and an alternative water system would be provided. Much of Gustavus has now been on bottled water for going on 2 years. It has been being delivered and provided by DOT for the last, I guess, about 18 months. Across the state, there are many other communities whose testing has been done, the same labs, the same data being gathered, but they are no longer at action levels because we shifted to the EPA's level of action. And that's why we're asking for it in statute, to direct that DEC will take action to make sure that safe water is available in every community that meets those levels.
One last follow-up. Mm-hmm. Sorry, thank you. So is there anything currently in statute that would bar individual communities for establishing whatever levels they deem appropriate to set that either in ordinance or as a policy that the community itself chooses to follow and enforce and give a little bit more local control to these communities?
Madam Chair, so are you asking whether a city or a community can set a water standard for their drinking water?
For their level, yeah.
I actually don't know. That's one of those, I don't know that question. And I'm not sure whether we have
more experience.
I don't know what city rights are to set water drinking standards. I can tell you that in the community Gustavus that brought this to my attention, there is no community water system. Everyone is on well water.
And Madam Chair, if I could add something that might help with the representative's further understanding of the reply to her question. There is nothing in the bill that prohibits DEC from, in the future, setting minimum allowable levels that are in fact lower than the ones that this bill puts in statute. So they would have that flexibility in terms of if these levels in the future were found still to be harmful, they could correct that.
Thank you.
Any other questions at this time before we do the sectional? And then we do have the invited testimony, so I want to do that because of, you know, having someone from out of town. And then we do have other agency folks and want to give them time as well. So hopefully that'll all happen in the next 35 minutes. I think we'll be okay. Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the sectional for the committee substitute here, and I'll try to get through it quickly. Section 1 of the bill creates several new sections in AS 46.03. In 03340A, directs the Department of Environmental Conservation to test drinking water near PFAS spills, requires the department to make sure anyone with contaminated drinking water gets clean water, and up to 3 years of voluntary blood testing for PFAS levels. The bill also in 03340B sets health-based maximum levels of contamination in drinking water for 7 PFAS chemicals and maintains DEC's authority to set more protective thresholds. That was what I was referring to a moment ago. In 340C, it requires DEC to make sure a responder exposed to PFAS contamination gets up to 3 years of voluntary blood testing for PFAS levels. That would be, say, a firefighter who was using the substance, or even possibly someone responding to a spill. Section 4603345A states that a person who causes a fire that results in the release of PFAS-containing foams is liable for the costs of providing drinking water testing and blood testing under the previous section of the bill. 345B states that a person who uses PFAS-containing substances to extinguish a fire, that is, fire departments, are not liable for drinking water testing and blood testing costs. 345C states that the liability for these costs, in addition to other liability existing in areas of state law relevant to the relevant to the release of PFAS substances. 350A exempts oil and gas businesses from the prohibition from using PFAS firefighting foams unless the state fire marshal publishes notice that an alternative firefighting substance that is safe and equally effective must be used. 350B states that if the state fire marshal determines that a safe and effective alternative firefighting substance is available for use by the oil and gas business, the fire marshal must immediately publish notice that the alternative substance must be adopted by the industry. 350C, in this section, DEC must take up to 25 gallons of PFAS-containing firefighting foam, or actually PFAS itself, I should amend that, from Alaskans for disposal. The idea being that those costs, we would hope, would not be borne by communities that are already having a bit of a struggle with resources these days. But, 350D states that with the exception of oil and gas businesses, this subsection prohibits the use of PFAS-containing firefighting substances by persons in the state unless the use is required by federal law. And later in the bill, there's a section providing an effective date for this prohibition of October 1st, 2021, and that's when federal government is expected to put that ban into effect. And 03359 lists the PFAS compounds covered by the bill and maintains DEC's authority to list more. Section 2 of the bill addresses the retroactive applicability of the liability in sections, or those earlier liability sections of the Act. Section 3 adds transition language regarding the adoption of regulations for implementing the Act and the effective date of those regulations. Section 4 gives an immediate effective date to Sections 2 and 3. Section 5 provides an effective date of October 4th, 2021 to the prohibition on the use of PFAS in Section 1. And Section 6 provides for an effective date of January 1st, 2021 for the bill, except for those sections provided an immediate effective date or other effective date, you know, in these preceding sections.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. I think we have a question from Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do any of you have any data on firemen who have trained or used PFAS on fires that have contracted, you know, your pancreatic cancer or any other types of cancer? Is it more just related to leaching into community well waters that we're more trying to talk about here?
I don't have that data at hand. I believe a couple of our expert witnesses may be able to address that, or Representative Tarr, who has had a bill about firefighters exposed to fire retardants, including these PFAS compounds, based on their level of toxicity and cancer rates. So it could be that the Alaska Network on
Community Action on Toxics.
Thank you. Alaska Community Action on Toxics could speak to that because they've been engaged in both of those bills.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I think since we do have that invited testimony, I think we'll just wait for that. And then, if that's okay with you, Representative Rauscher. Representative Rasmussen.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So why was the determination for voluntary blood testing to go through DEC instead of HESS?
It, through the chair, it is just to make DEC the point on all of these. It's not that they're going to, for instance, they're not necessarily going to be doing the blood testing or even the field sampling of the water or the distribution of alternative water systems, but it makes DEC the point on all of the aspects of making sure that the components are addressed.
Follow-up?
Quick follow-up, yeah. Okay, so what would the, I'm trying to think of the word, not sample, the, I guess, criteria to compare blood tests to, how would we determine that? Because if we're taking blood tests from people, but we don't really have a base of the blood samples, I'm just a little bit confused about the relevance of that.
Through the chair, again, there's an expert witness, we'll talk to it, but there's sort of a circular nature of the catch-22 that has gone on in the communities that have had exposure, is that the CDC hasn't set blood level risks that tell us what your risk of getting testicular cancer are, so we don't take blood samples because there's not a causality already accepted by DEC, yet there is a lot of science that you'll hear about from an expert today that tells us that there are testicular cancer is one that comes to mind that showed up in both animal testing and then human sampling. But we get caught in a catch-22 where no one's, before those have shown up, taken the baseline blood samples. So people go, it doesn't tell us anything. I will assert that in Alaska, most of our exposures to PFAS have not been industrial waste, that our PFAS exposures have been either for household goods because you had Teflon pans or wore a Gore-Tex jacket, or your water system. And since we don't have a lot of industrial use of PFAS, that it's exclusively our exposures in Alaska, except for household exposures, that we provide some of the best guinea pigs of humans to what the waterborne standards of exposure are going to show us in 10 years. And it's a really sad thing to think of, but the chemicals have been studied for about 50 years and have shown repeated particular cancers that they're linked to in both humans and animals. And for the communities that have been exposed, they've been asking for it. And so it is an element that I think I'd like to see us try to address as a legislature.
Thank you.
Any other questions before we go to the invited testimony? Okay, thank you so much, Representative Hannon and Mr. Clark. We will go to the first invited testifier. And at this time, I'm going to remove my objection to adopting the committee substitute as the working version. Any other objection to that? Okay, so then that will be our working document, version M. And I'd like to invite Mr. Rob Blatt to come forward. And if you could please put yourself on the record and any affiliation. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Rob Balot, and I'm an attorney with the law firm of Taft, Stettinius & Hollister out of Cincinnati, Ohio, and Northern Kentucky.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. And do you have prepared testimony first or are available for questions?
I could speak for a few minutes, and then I'm happy to answer questions.
Perfect. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you all for inviting me here, and it's a real privilege to be able to be here today to talk to you all. I've come here hoping to try to provide as much information as I can about what do we know about PFAS chemicals. What are they? What does the science tell us? Where did the science come from? And how is that impacting the folks here in Alaska? And what would be the most appropriate things for folks to be focusing on that are concerned about protecting human health and the environment here in this state? Yeah, I first started working on these issues 20 years ago. I work at a large law firm that typically represents big companies, big corporate chemical companies particularly. But I first got involved in this case to help a farmer out in West Virginia who had cattle who were being exposed to these chemicals. And through that case, we learned about the existence, frankly, of these chemicals, in particular one called PFOA that historically had been used in the manufacture of Teflon in West Virginia. And what we now know is we're talking about chemicals in this family. There are several hundred, if not several thousand, in the class of PFAS chemicals. They are completely man-made synthetic chemicals. They do not exist in nature. So when we find them in our water, in our soil, in our wildlife, in the blood of virtually every person on the planet, in babies being born, they are traceable back to the companies that actually manufactured the raw chemicals and put them out into the environment. And it was through many years of litigation, actually, out in West Virginia and Ohio, that we came to understand what was known about these chemicals. You know, these chemicals came out into the world decades before the U.S. EPA existed, decades before a lot of the U.S. environmental laws came into play about chemicals. Yet the companies understood a lot about the chemicals and were doing a lot of research, a lot of studies. And what we see when I had the rare opportunity through litigation, through discovery, to see literally millions of pages of documents from the manufacturers. And what we saw were decades of studies, toxicology studies with animals going back to the 1960s and 70s, human health studies among workers in the 70s and 80s and 90s, studies of the impacts in the environment. And what we saw was even though the federal and state regulators didn't necessarily even know of the existence of these chemicals, a lot was known and a lot was done to look into what these chemicals were and how they behaved in the environment and in humans. And from looking at all of that data, it became clear that what we were dealing with were chemicals that were known to be incredibly persistent in the environment when they got out into the environment, this unique chemical bond of carbon and fluorine is almost impossible to break down. So when these chemicals get out in the environment, they stay there virtually forever. They do not break down under normal biological conditions, which is why you hear them now referred to as forever chemicals. But they also have this uncanny ability to get into human blood, and they get into the blood of animals and wildlife that are exposed. And they not only get in the blood, but they build up over time. They persist. They stay in the body, and they build up. They bioaccumulate. They get into wildlife, into fish, into larger animals. They've been found in polar bears. They have an uncanny ability to get out into our environment and move very rapidly in water. They can move through the air. They get up into the clouds and can rain down. That's why we are finding these chemicals now in polar bears, in Arctic ice caps, nowhere near manufacturing facilities. And from what we've seen in all the years of sifting through all these internal documents, what became clear was these chemicals were toxic, they were persistent, they were bioaccumulative, and they presented serious public health threats. I started providing this information to the U.S. EPA when I saw it and understood nobody had seen it, and the government regulators didn't necessarily know about this information. I started providing that to the U.S. EPA March 6, 2001, 19 years ago. And that's my letter where I originally asked the U.S. EPA to move forward and set appropriate drinking water standards and safety guidelines. That was 19 years ago. And through the litigation, this information finally was coming out. We dragged it out through the litigation, provided it to the regulators, to the scientific community, to the public. And through our litigation, once this information finally started coming out, we were able to settle that case. And we settled it in a very unique way, where we set up an independent panel of scientists that were selected by the company, by DuPont, and by the community. These had to be completely independent scientists, not biased in any way, not related to one side or the other. Their task was to look at what will this chemical do to people actually drinking it in their water over time. And we defined the group they were to study by their dose level. And we defined it as people who were exposed to 50 parts per trillion in their water for a year or more. What would drinking PFOA in that group, what was that linked to? What human diseases? And we gave that panel discretion to do whatever studies were needed. They ended up conducting some of the most comprehensive human health studies ever done on any chemical. We ended up getting 69,000 people from that community who participated, provided blood, provided medical information, all of which was turned over to this independent panel that not only looked at all of the data from the community, but they also looked at all of the published peer-reviewed articles, all of the worker data, all of the animal data, all of it. And their task was to look at all of this information and render a decision about whether there was sufficient connection between drinking this in the water and actual human disease to people exposed to it. They spent 7 years doing that with over 69,000 people, 12 different massive epidemiological studies, some of the most comprehensive human health studies ever done. And at the end of the day, they were able to link PFOA with 6 different diseases: kidney cancer, testicular cancer, ulcerative colitis, thyroid disease, preeclampsia, and high cholesterol. And once those links came out, keep in mind, DuPont had agreed, once those links were shown, no, they would not dispute PFOA can cause those diseases in those humans at those levels. So that was a critical thing that you don't normally have in the scientific world, where you've got agreement that once you've reached this level of science, that's sufficient to show the chemical can cause those diseases at that dose level. So that was done. And once that data came in, it was given to the US EPA. And once again, we said, please move forward with setting appropriate drinking water standards across the country. Because this chemical wasn't just used in Teflon in West Virginia. It's been used in making all kinds of different products, not only firefighting foams, but stain-resistant carpeting, clothing, fast food wrappers, packaging, likely all over the country. So In 2012, we asked again for a safety drinking water standard. That's when US EPA first started requiring public water supplies to actually go out and start testing for PFOA and PFOS for the first time. 2013, 2014, that data starts coming in. It's showing this across the country. We ended up actually going to trial with DuPont for the people in the community who had these diseases. And the whole point of the trial was, did DuPont actually cause these diseases? And the trials, we took the trial three times. All three, DuPont was held to have caused the cancer in these people. And in fact, the last two trials came back with punitive damages, that the company had acted with conscious disregard of the risks from these chemicals. In the middle of the fourth, they settled those trials for those claims for the other 3,500 people in that community. So once that data came out and that data was being collected, information finally started to trickle out that these chemicals were likely in water across the country. An article came out in the New York Times in January of 2016 that summarized this history. Communities across the country realized this and started saying, what's the safe level of this in the water? That's when US EPA came out with their very first drinking water guideline for PFOA and PFOS, the 70 parts per trillion. And that's what's critically important to remember. That is still just a guideline. It is not enforceable. It is not an enforceable standard. And when that guideline came out, the Department of Defense went out and started identifying sites where this stuff had been used in foam outside military bases and airports, started finding it. Communities across the country, including in Alaska, right, are finding this in their water, and they're finding it above these levels. Yet the problem is the communities and the water providers are suddenly faced with having to incur the cost of cleaning this up, having to actually get it out of the water, yet they're told, yeah, but you're doing it voluntarily because it's not an official government regulation or requirement at this point. So what you see happening across the country since then are states saying, we have been waiting for 20 years for the US EPA to take action on these chemicals. US EPA came out with its first action plan to set, claiming it would move forward to set drinking water standards, to set declare these hazards in 2009. 10 years later, they come out with yet another action plan, where again we hear the EPA is moving forward toward these standards. But as we sit here today in 2020, there is still not an enforceable federal standard. So states are moving forward, recognizing the way that people are to be protected in the states have to move forward and actually set enforceable standards. And that's what we see happening. And you see, I know there are questions about why are these numbers, for example, being, and I'm not here to testify about any particular piece of legislation. I'm here to talk about the background. But what we see happening is the states and the regulators and the scientific community, as they look at this data, as they start looking at this, the numbers are going lower and lower and lower. Because as more information comes out, the concern is the stuff stays in us. It stays in our blood. It builds up over time. So regardless of what the level is on a particular day, the concern is about this long-term exposure. So even if you look back in the history, the very first entity to set a drinking water standard for PFAS was DuPont in 1988. And internally, they set it just about at the detection level. Their concern was the persistence, the toxicity, the biopersistence. And what we see is the states that can look at this, for example, in Michigan, they had a scientific panel, which included one of our science panelists from West Virginia. As they look at this data, those numbers are going down. Even at the federal level, ATSDR is recommending much lower levels than we see at the US EPA. So to conclude, and I don't want to speak too long, I'm sorry, but to conclude, these are chemicals that are impacting all of us. They are impacting people here in this state. And likely, as sampling starts around additional places throughout not only this state but across the world, we're going to see more of PFAS showing up in water in more and more places. And it's critically important for the communities that are exposed, that are incurring the costs of having to get clean water, bottled water, blood testing, that they have an ability to ever recover those. And they can't if there's no enforceable standard. Because what they're told, as a lawyer I can tell you, as when you go into court, they're told, well, you voluntarily incurred those costs on your own. So that's why you see states that are moving forward to set enforceable standards so that the water providers, the communities, are able to do this, to take steps to protect people, but also at some point hopefully recover those costs so that the taxpayers aren't sacked with those costs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate your testimony and giving us that insight. I think we probably have time for a few questions here because we do have one other invited testifier, and we have till about 4 after is when we started, so to give the hour there. So any questions for Mr. Blatt? Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for your presentation. This high impact. How, when it gets in your blood and it does accumulate, is there any way that you can get it out of your blood? Is there a proven system or sweating it out, or what do we do?
You know, unfortunately, that's a real problem. Once this gets in the blood, really it's the passage of time. These chemicals have what they call a long half-life. They stay in the body. The body, because they're completely man-made synthetic chemicals, the body doesn't know how to get rid of them. So they tend to stay. They don't even deposit in the blood, in the fat. They circulate in the blood, which is very concerning because then they coat all of these blood-rich organs like kidneys, etc. And researchers are trying to find a way to speed up that process. And unfortunately, there isn't really a known method for doing that other than some extreme things such as almost like dialysis, cleaning of the blood. So we're talking about a fairly, this is a significant problem because the exposures are continuing because this stuff remains in our environment. Even though the chemicals have been phased out years ago, a lot of those chemicals, those products are still there. They're still sitting in foams that are sitting in airports, in military bases, in petroleum companies that bought this stuff years ago. That stuff is still out there. So it remains an ongoing exposure problem.
Follow-up?
Another question. Thank you, Madam Chair. How long, you might have mentioned this before, and I'm sorry I stepped out for a moment, but I'm hearing that DuPont actually was limiting their exposure for their own employees at detection levels back in 1988. So I'm guessing that this PFOA has been used way before that time as well, I'm assuming. And then we see that DuPont actually, I think, helped in being on the panelists or actually worked with the scientific community to look at these levels and determine what levels would be acceptable or what we should be concerned about. In DuPont doing that, are they did they reduce any liability for themselves in participating like that, or how did DuPont get involved with the scientific part if they were concerned about potential lawsuits against themselves?
Yeah, let me clarify that. DuPont was in fact doing studies on animals. They were monitoring. They were actually monitoring the blood levels in the workers. They were doing epidemiology health studies of the workers. And the level I referred to, though, was they actually set a community exposure guideline because they were aware this chemical was getting into the public water by early as 1984. So that level they had set was a drinking water guideline for the community. And when we then set up this independent panel, DuPont had to provide the funding, but they were not allowed to be on the panel, or it had to be independent scientists who were doing the science. DuPont wanted that. The community wanted that. So they provided funding, but they were not controlling the science.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. just two things that come up when we talk about this. One, you know, there's often a myriad of bad health outcomes, and I think that sometimes can be confusing because people are thinking sort of like, you know, if you're exposed to this chemical, everybody's going to react in the same way. And so just among your clients, to the extent you can share, you know, some of the different kind of things that you saw. And then the second thing is we're always looking for more public health research. But one of the things I just mentioned at a previous bill hearing was just states are very limited in what we can accomplish because it's really expensive. It takes a long time. You mentioned, you know, they worked on this for 7 years. But I had heard you earlier say how much it cost. And I just thought that would be important for all of us because one of the challenges is we just don't have the funds to really accomplish sometimes what you were able to do.
Right. As far as the health effects, the six diseases I mentioned were the ones that were linked by the independent panel. There are a number of other health effects that have been observed in humans and in different communities, and researchers since the science panel have found a number of additional effects, particularly with vaccine response. Which is particularly concerning. And a lot of these lower numbers that are coming out from state agencies are based on the fact this chemical seems to inhibit the immune system, and particularly in children. So that's been a real concern. Now, as far as the funding, doing this kind of epidemiology work is incredibly expensive. And we had the fortunate ability of being able to get that funding through litigation in a settlement with DuPont. And so what we're seeing across the country are other states are actually bringing claims, trying to get a way to seek those funds from the manufacturers of the chemicals themselves, and are bringing claims because of that, because there are such incredible expenses involved with doing statewide testing, doing the sampling, providing the information through the health department, and providing clean water in emergency situations.
And I just want to make sure I don't get the number wrong. Did you say in the lunch and learn it was $70 million, and then you added $35 million more?
Yeah, and under the work that was done in West Virginia, we used $70 million through a class action settlement. That amount was used to collect the blood data from the 70,000 people and the medical records and analysis. That was to collect the raw data. It then cost another approximately $33 to $35 million for the scientists to then analyze all that data. So you're talking over $100 million was spent to do those independent science studies that confirmed these links.
Thank you. Yeah, those are just numbers that would be very hard for us to accomplish. And, you know, why I think it's just so critical, we're sort of looking at what work is happening in other states and other, you know, other research to help inform us because it's just, like you say, it's so expensive.
Yes, and that's why there are a number of folks that are saying there was a lot of money spent to confirm these links and to get this science done on PFOA. And if we keep saying, well, we need that level of science for each one of these PFAS chemicals, this will take forever. You know, they'll give a new dimension to the term forever chemicals. Hmm. And each time somebody slightly tweaks this, you know, we're removing one carbon and suddenly it's a new chemical and we have to start all over again. This process goes on forever. So in order to protect people and to make sure that we're using what was done effectively, people are suggesting we take this information and apply that to this entire class, which all share the same characteristics, move forward now.
Thank you. I apologize. I think we're do you have just to brief us a comment because we have one more person in the next, like, 7 minutes.
Another quick question, hopefully. So if I were to go to my doctor with some thyroid problems, for example, is my doctor going to know to check my blood levels to see if I'm exposed? Or what are doctors and clinicians doing these days? And can a general lab do these detections?
That's a real problem. The general medical community has unfortunately not known a lot about this. The information wasn't made widely available to the medical community. Part of our settlement, not only did we have an independent panel of scientists that confirmed the links with disease, once those links were found, we worked with DuPont to set up a second panel of independent medical doctors who then made recommendations about what testing would be appropriate for people who've been exposed. That's out there now on the internet. C-8medicalmonitoringprogram.com. It's available to any doctor, anybody who wants to go to their doctor and say, I think I've been exposed, what kinds of tests would be appropriate. This is the independent medical panel's recommendations. They're out there, available for everybody.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It.
Thank you, Mr. Blatt. Really appreciate your time and being with us today. And our second invited testifier, Kelly McLaughlin, if you could please come forward. She is from the community of Gustavus. And I think there's a group there that I don't have your name for. It's the
Gustavus PFAS Action Coalition.
There we go. So if you could please put yourself on the record and the affiliation, we appreciate it. And we're trying to wrap up this portion of the meeting around 2:05. So
my name is Kelly McLaughlin. I'm from Gustavus, and I'm representing the Gustavus PFAS Action Coalition. We formed a year and a half ago after a brief stint of really just not knowing what to do. We had this information that our property was contaminated, much like the information that our blood is contaminated, and now what? And there's no information. So we got together and we called everybody that we could think of to possibly call and ask all the questions that we could think of, and we asked for our blood to be tested, and I was nursing at the time, so I wanted my breast milk tested. I wanted to know, you know, what's going into my daughter and what effects is that going to have on her future. And my son also was in utero with PFAS contamination. So we formed this group and we started writing letters, and there was at that time Walker was still the governor, and there was a regulation package going through DEC, so it was a public comment period around this time that we were getting our test results back. So we all put in public comment to try to lower the level, because at the time it was combined total of 5 with an extra 6 chemical to make 70, I think actually it was 65 parts per trillion was the action level. So we, at that time, a year and a half ago, it was evident that that was still too high, even with the combined total of 5 PFAS chemicals. So we wrote all of our public comment to say, kind of arbitrarily, we pulled 20 parts per trillion from other states, what other states were doing. New Jersey was one of the first states to actually make proactive measures and set really low standards of 13 or 14 parts per trillion for different chemicals. So we had, I don't know, probably 20 different public testimonies asking for the level to be lowered. And that regulation package disappeared when Dunleavy took office. And the standards were then reverted back. So as you heard earlier, Representative Hannon was saying that the clean water at my house is different than the clean water at my neighbor's house. So somebody that lives 100 yards from me, their standard is different than mine is. And so this property that I'm referring to was sold under this new standard that doesn't hit 70. So they were told it was clean when they bought it. So the whole, there's so many questions. This is such a huge, huge topic, and it's so hard to focus on one part of it and get all of the scope of it. Like, there's all these great questions here, and it's going to, I mean, hopefully you all go home and Google it for hours, because you can. But we're here because there hasn't been action taken. We asked for blood tests, and we were told no. They're necessary because we need that data. So even if all the state of Alaska does is blood tests, and we have that data that these people drinking this water have this level in their blood, we'll be a step ahead of where we are now, and we can apply that to health effects later. We're here because the regulation package disappeared, and that's why we need it in regulation, so that, I'm sorry, I'm not good at government, but
statute.
We need it in statute so that it can be regulated. And we are here because none of this happened, because DOT is the responsible party, but they're not doing anything. I mean, we need action. We need the entire state to be tested. We need people in Wrangell to know that if they live next to the airport, their water's probably contaminated and they should not be drinking it. And I think people all over the state are drinking contaminated water believing that it's safe, and their kids are born with health effects because of this. And the health effects are not evident until their kids go through puberty or reach adulthood. And this is an enormous problem, and we have to start somewhere. So anything that we can do, and I think this packet does a lot, this bill does a lot to protect the health of Alaskans. But the main things is we need it stopped. We need no more PFAS in Alaska to the fullest extent that we can. And already there is an existing exemption from the FAA already for Index A airports, of which there are 11, I believe, in Alaska. So we could have always been, and we could currently be using sodium bicarbonate and not AFFF. So Gustavus could have avoided this problem, Homer could have avoided this problem. There's, you know, I think there's 11 of them. So we could switch today to a totally non-toxic alternative, and we could start phasing out AFFF in Alaska today and replacing it with a non-fluorinated foam. They're being used around the world, effectively. London Heathrow, all of Australia. Pam can talk more to this if there's time for her to come up. But yeah, we've got experts in this room. We've got experts around the state. Let's do something so we can start moving forward. And I did bring my eggs, which I'll show you, because they're contaminated too. I've got 9 dozen sitting up at my dad's house. I don't know what to do with them because I can't eat them. The test results came back 13 to 25,000 parts per trillion. And my well tested 133. So this bioaccumulates like crazy in animals. Wow. Thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. McLaughlin. Any questions? Representative Hopkins.
Thank you for coming forward to us and coming down here and your fight that you're putting forward in Gustavus for this. I'm from Fairbanks and have a fair number of these contaminated sites as well. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that none of your eggs are edible whatsoever in the 9 dozen that you have that are continuing to be laid. None of them are edible. Do other people in your community, have they seen similar concerns with their eggs and their any other produce or anything that they've grown that has similar amounts of contamination?
So, yes, through the chair, GPAC has done some testing around Gustavus. We were able to test eggs and produce through a grant from ACAT. And the eggs both tested, my neighbor's eggs tested higher than mine even. His were about 25,000 on the higher end, and mine were on the lower 13,000 end. We tested kale, which showed levels, I believe they're around 200 parts per trillion, kind of the lowest that you can register. And mint, garden mint tested fairly high. We tested potatoes and rhubarb. Those neither came back, but the non-detect level is fairly high. So coming back non-detect doesn't necessarily mean anything. What else did we test? We've tested more eggs to try to determine, you know, whether there are clean eggs outside of the plume or if this is an issue that might, you know, just be inherent in eggs and chickens or who knows. So we're working on, oh, we tested Orange Delicious mushrooms also, which also came back non-detect, which is very interesting. And that's something that we're working on. We'd really like to test the salmon in the Salmon River because the plume has reached the Salmon River, mm-hmm. And it does. The river has small levels of detectable PFOS.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I don't know if folks recalled, but ACAT did a report about some of the testing, and I think some of this is in there. And if we haven't already shared that with members, we will in preparation for the next hearing. And I apologize that we are out of time for any more discussion on this today. But we do plan to continue hearing this bill on Friday. And so Ms. Miller will continue the discussion and can have you start, I think, on Friday, and then we'll go into the public testimony. And if there's any other documents or anything we need in advance of that to be prepared, we'll try to make sure that everybody has those. Any other comments or thoughts on that bill? Okay. I'm just going to take a brief at ease so people can get their paperwork for transition to the HB 138. Brief at ease. When we did the last amendment. So we're just going to go over, and if folks have the amendment packet, if you're watching online, the amendments have been updated to say which ones were adopted and if they were amended. So just to review where we're at, amendment number one was amended with conceptual amendments, and then it was adopted. Amendment number two was amended, and then it was adopted. Amendment number three was withdrawn after discussion, but we will consider today amendment number 12 offered in its place. So we'll come back to that. Amendment number four had been withdrawn. Amendment number five is one we will consider today. Amendment number six is one we will consider today. Amendment number seven is one we will consider today. Amendment number 8 is one we'll consider today. Amendment number 9 is one we'll consider today. We do not have, Amendment number 10 we'll also do. 11 passed at our last meeting with no objection. And then the ones that you see at the end of the packet were all related to conversation and sort of technical pieces to be addressed by the earlier conversations. So amendment number 13, again, it's new. We're going to consider that one. 14 was new, not considered. And we have some conceptual amendments possibly for these, and then a couple 15 and 16 after that. So we will just start at the pile where we left off, and that will be with amendment number 5 by Representative Hannon. And so, Representative Hannon, if you'd like to move amendment number 5.
Through the chair, I move amendment number 5.
And I'll object for discussion.
This amendment removes language on page 3 of the committee substitute that requires a person nominating an outstanding national resource water to include a cost-benefit analysis of the designation. It removes language stating that the water nomination also include, quote, other information required by the commission. The cost-benefit analysis is likely to be costly and burdensome for individuals making nominations. And I feel like it would be best left to the commission or an affiliated state agency to address a thorough cost-benefit analysis. And the, quote, other information required by the commission is far too broad and opens the way for an endless series of demands for a nomination to be complete or considered.
Thank you, Representative Hannon. Any questions for the maker of the amendment, Representative Rasmussen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. My concern with this amendment is that we may have, I don't want to say arbitrary, but cases come forward and the state ends up paying a sizable amount for the cost-benefit analysis. And with the news of our oil prices today and our stocks and every other issue that Alaska's having financially, taking on an additional financial burden seems really hard to swallow for me. So I will be opposing this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Any other questions or comments? I'm just going to take one brief at ease while people are reading. We have a number of amendments, and it's been a little bit since we heard the bill. I just want to let folks have an opportunity to kind of reorient themselves and read, and myself included. I wanted to point members to amendment number 10 that also addresses this, and not that we're considering two amendments at the same time, but people may want to look at amendment number 10 because it has some modified language to address this same issue. If there aren't other committee questions for the amendment sponsor at this time, I'm going to ask the bill sponsor if they would like to comment on amendment number 5.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Chuck Kopp, Representative, House District 24. I have with me my team member, Trevor Fulton. Madam Chair, this amendment seems it reduces to a question of, do we want the commission to be restrained in its ability outside of minimum criteria offered for nomination to be able to ask for any more information? In my view, it would seem it's hard to make a cookie cutter list of questions to be addressed. We tried to keep it simple and straightforward for ease of process. The balance of the commission itself, I think, promotes reasonableness. This committee has already adopted amendments to kind of get at more of a balance, and I would think that to withdraw the ability of the commission to ask for an additional information point or criteria in order to come to a decision could be limiting to the commission. And then to the community itself, or I should say to the area itself that's being nominated, that cost-benefit analysis gets to future development of that community itself. Will you have a future road? Is your community growing? Where do you plan to put, a road to your own water treatment plant or your next neighborhood? Where's that going in? And will any of that involve Tier 3 waters? How will that impact the growth of your community? How will it impact the economic base of your community based on projects that are ongoing and, whatever economic engine is in the community? It's so varied that we felt like, at a minimum, to have these issues at least minimally addressed to the commission as a baseline starting point for the conversation shows that at least the nominator is aware of what's happening in the area that's being nominated. Otherwise, it could seem like a real oversight to not even talk about them and how it might affect either the growth of the community, the projects that are ongoing in that community, and any possible or foreseeable things coming down the track. I do feel like the nomination commission has some reasonableness to it and would probably be asking these questions anyway. And I think, but we're not saying it has to be 100 pages long and you have to have McDowell do it. It's clearly there's reasonableness in there. And the point of having, I believe, the identifiers be so simple and straightforward is to show that this is not meant to be a high hurdle. It's meant to be a reasonable hurdle, one that for such a designation any balanced commission would want. And so for that reason, I'm not super excited about the amendment, but that's where I'm at on that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, the other thing I will say is if you look at amendments 14, 13, and 14, one of them you'll notice includes this cost and benefit language, 13, and then 14 doesn't. So these are drafted dependent on kind of what we do with these earlier amendments. But the goal here, you'll notice we changed the language to be general description. So this was something we talked about with the bill sponsor, and so these things are sort of interwoven in three conversations here through these amendments. But the existing language had several different descriptions. So we had one that was an explanation, one was a description, one was a discussion, and one was an analysis. And so through amendments 13 and 14, depending on, we have two options depending on if we would adopt one of the earlier ones, we would modify that to just be a general description. And I felt like, as a sort of citizen looking through that lens, I was thinking, okay, well, what's the difference between description, discussion, analysis, and then explanation? And so, does that have like sort of a different set of expectations about each one, and that we might benefit from just asking for the general description, because that would be what a citizen would be qualified to provide without, hiring an outside firm or something. So again, we are on amendment number 5, but I just wanted to inform members' thinking on that, because we have kind of a few here that kind of work together a little bit and address these in, somewhat complementary ways. Okay, coming back to the amendment 5, Representative Hannon.
And thank you, Chair Tarr. I guess I'm going to continue to assert that to place an analysis and cost benefit at the ability to nominate puts a burden on communities, especially our smallest rural communities, in which we have 5 rivers currently nominated or 5 waterways, and all 5 of them by tribal entities. And many of those people and groups would not have the technical expertise to do that. And so to not even be able to nominate without a cost-benefit analysis was pointed out as a burden that keeps them from doing it. Now, I wouldn't foresee us creating that water that through the commission process, a cost-benefit analysis has to be done. That is an element of making that decision. But to not be able to nominate because you don't have the resources to provide that technical expertise or the economics to hire the analysts is too great a burden. Now, I probably can live with some of those other amendments that would address it, but at this point, I'm going to ask for my amendment to be considered and voted on.
Thank you, Representative Hannon. And that was sort of wrap up, but Representative Tuck raised his hand after, so I'm going to go ahead and go to that.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm looking at existing statutes, I mean, not statutes, but regulations, 18 AAC 70.017, Tier 3 Outstanding National Resource Water. And it looks like the nomination, it looks like for these nominations here, it follows parallel with what's in the bill, with the exception of that one section there, Section F. So it's also asking the name, description, and geographic location, the boundaries upstream and downstream, the extent of the water, including a map, information explaining how the water meets applicable requirements of Section C, which is this section right here, reasonable available information about adjacent landowners and land use designations and other reasonable available information, including information on existing uses, water quality, technical data, or records. So I see that we have in regulations similar requirements. And I don't know where I got this from. It just all of a sudden is in my binder. So I just, I'm assuming everybody else got this regulation. Anti-degradation, Tier 3 Outstanding National Resources Waters Nomination Designation Process. Well, I think when the regulations were written, they probably considered all of this. The goal is to get water designations, not to hinder it. So I'm going to at this time support the amendment.
Representative Tuck, do you have a date for the document that you're looking at, just to orient folks?
It's just a two-page document.
Okay. I'm not sure if we all have that same document, but if you share it with our committee, aide, perhaps if we don't already have it, then we can try to make it available to folks. Okay. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. May I let Mr. Fulton speak to
Sure.
issue? Thank you.
Please, if you wouldn't mind putting yourself on the record.
For the record, Trevor Fulton, staff to Representative Kopp. I don't believe I have the exact copy of what Representative Tuck was presenting there, but there are thinking two possibilities of what it might be. One is the regulations that have already been adopted for the implementation side of the process, and that's what would happen if somebody wanted to discharge into a water that had already been designated a Tier 3 water. What we're discussing with HB 138 is the actual designation process, not the implementation process. So they're two different things. The other thing that document could have been would have been a draft implementation document that was put out in 2010 that has since been rescinded with the 2018 publication of the internal guidance memo saying the process, DEC defers the process to the legislature. I hope that lends some clarity.
Representative Tuck, any other comments on that?
Yeah, it was just attached to Alaska Miners Association document that is in my binder. So sounds like I'm not sure if these regulations are in place right now, or what I'm hearing is that the regulations were in place and no longer in place. I don't know. But I do think that analysis of economic cost and benefit of designated water is, I mean, will we make a different decision if it's not economically feasible, or if it's, I mean, we would think that a water designation would benefit the community if they're wanting to preserve water. I'm just not sure how that factors and if it should factor. So at this time, I'm still going to support the amendment.
Thank you. Sure, we'll take a brief at ease. let's go back on the record. We do have Mr. Robert Bates from DEC. Are you able to, pardon me? Randy, it's Robert on my sheet. Okay, Mr. Randy Bates.
That's his real life.
Yes. I did think it was Randy, but it says Robert, so then I thought I was remembering wrong.
You may want to ask what his pronouns are, this joke.
So Representative Tuck has this document that he's looking at, and just for clarification, could you speak to what that is? Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Tuck, my name is Randy Bates. I'm the Director of Water within the Department of Environmental Conservation. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. To the best of my knowledge, and again, I've been here for a little more than a month. Thank you for the opportunity to continue to educate myself. To the best of my knowledge, Representative, I do not see within our package of 18 AAC 70 an existing regulation as you've cited it.
Okay, thank you.
I will confirm that and get back. Again, my knowledge is growing but limited, but I have the package of 18 AAC 70 with me, and it's not in there. So I believe either it's a draft, as the representative and his staff mentioned, or it's a previous regulation that we have since replaced. Okay?
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, then if he could share that document with you, and then if there is any additional follow-up, that'd be great, and then we can just let committee members know.
Randy will be here for you for the rest of the
day. That sounds really good. Appreciate that. Representative Tuck, did you have any other question or comment?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it.
Okay, Representative Rasmussen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think in response to the previous speaker, when we look at the Constitution, Article 8, Section 2, and it says the legislature shall provide for the utilization, development, and conservation of all natural resources belonging to the state, including land and waters, for the maximum benefit of the people. And I think that there's multiple ways for us to define maximum benefit, but one piece of that that does need to be evaluated is a cost-benefit analysis, because whether they're looking at what the cost would be to the community if they were to not designate a body of water and they were to lose access to salmon and other renewable resources, or whether they're looking at the cost of discharge that would be a result of putting in a new mine, what type of benefit that would provide to a community. Those are both things that really need to be considered in the overall decision, and that's why I think that this specific amendment isn't appropriate for what we're trying to accomplish and also for truly supporting the Constitution.
Representative Lincoln.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also object to this amendment. I agree that requiring a very in-depth and expensive economic cost-benefit analysis is inappropriate for a nominator, but I strongly prefer other amendments that we'll consider on this bill that still requires a quote, general description of those activities, and that, as Rep. Rasmussen pointed out, that economic activity can be purely environmentally friendly and sustainable. From the regulations, it talks about the economic importance of the water, including but not limited to drinking water supply, commercial and sport fishing, and other water-dependent businesses. So for those reasons, I will object to this amendment.
Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also kind of want to chime in on the other amendments that we had mentioned. I think there was probably some really good work done by some people to come up with a reasonable alternative to doing a cost-benefit analysis with that general description, which I really can't see anyone submitting any nomination at all without providing a really good general description anyway, and particularly based on that local knowledge of everything that might happen and transpire in that area. So I too am in opposition to this amendment, but I think the folks that had thought about these others put some serious thought into that. I think that's very appropriate language. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? Representative Sponholz.
So I am actually the maker of the one of the co-sponsors of the other amendment that's in question, and I really appreciate the intention of the sponsor of the amendment that we're considering right now. I think that it is the case that asking for an economic benefit analysis is, you know, that would be done in a more formal way is really inappropriate. It puts too much economic burden on a nominator, but I think that in a later amendment we've worked to try to strike sort of a balance which says that they should describe the costs, they should describe the impacts, but not necessarily require a study, sort of strikes what I think is a balance between those two things, and so I won't be supporting this amendment.
Any other comments from members? Representative Hopkins.
Thanks. Just quickly, I'm going to agree with the previous speakers as well, I think previous four of them. I do appreciate where the sponsor of this amendment is going, because I have a lot of concerns about the objective nature of the decisions when it comes to the recommendations from the this commission. I know at this point in E, where they're laying out the seven different steps, I believe it's seven different steps that they'll have to come forward to put forward a nomination, makes sense. I do think they need to have a general description, as the later amendments discuss, about the cost benefits and what it looks like down the road for those communities. But as we're moving forward in this process, I have concerns about the objective nature of how these commissions are going to be putting, how this commission is going to be putting forward its recommendations to the legislature, because I don't see further descriptions in there unless I'm missing it, about the objective nature of what those decisions will have to look like. So I will be opposing this but supporting the later amendments. So I appreciate the nominator bringing this discussion forward. Oh, sorry, not the nominator, the amendment sponsor bringing this issue forward. So thank you, Representative Hannon.
Okay. Any other comments? I'm sorry, I think I got a little ahead of the process there, Representative Hannon, with other committee members having comments. So did you want to say anything now in wrap up?
I'll wrap it up and say I will withdraw this, but hold your attention to the fact that, you know, my assertion is that a cost-benefit analysis by the nominator is at the wrong point in the process. Certainly a description of the economic benefits, and I believe before it could be designated, a thorough analysis should be done. But I have deep concerns about putting that burden and preventing people from nominating. So with hearing your concerns and support for later amendments that should address this issue, I'll go ahead and withdraw amendment number 5.
Thank you, Representative Hannon. And with permission from committee members, I'd like to ask us to do amendment number 10 next, because that is most very closely related and why our brain is kind of on that topic. And this is by Representative Sponholz and Lincoln. Representative Sponholz?
Co-Chair Tarr, I move amendment number 10.
And I'll object for discussion.
So amendment number 10, I think, proposes to strike sort of a balance or a compromise position in terms of the issue of description of costs and benefits of a Tier 3 water designation. We are proposing that it be a general description of the foreseeable impacts, and that those impacts not only include cost and benefits, but also the impacts on cultural and subsistence uses, which I think are particularly important in our state. And that within 1 year of finding a nomination of compliance, that the commission make a decision on the nomination.
Any committee member questions? And we'll just take a moment for folks to read. Okay, we do have a question from Representative Hopkins, and if we need to take an at ease, that of course is totally fine. I'm just trying to move a little bit slowly so people can, again, orient themselves to the amendment and where it's at in the bill. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, and to the makers of the amendment. On page 2 of the amendment, final three lines, delete E or F and insert E. Does that what does that do, and does that make the recommendation a final decision by the commission, final action position? What does that do?
Can we take a brief at
ease? A brief at ease? The record at 2:40. I'm going to let Representative Sponholz make a comment here, then to Trevor in the bill sponsor's office, and then we're also trying to get Marie Marks on the line to be available if there's still another question. So, thank Representative Sponholz.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Tarr. So, the reference, the section that is being referenced by Vice Chair Hopkins was conforming changes that were recommended by Legislative Legal's Marie Marks, and I'm wondering if we can invite her to describe what it is that she intended here.
And we are trying to get her on the line as we speak. And so, Representative Kopp, if you or your staff also had a comment while we're trying to get her.
Yes, Madam Chair, for the record, Chuck Kopp, House Representative for District 24. So I think this is a good amendment, Madam Chair. I do appreciate that it more generally describes what we are looking for without being so prescriptive on the analysis that needs to be done with respect to costs and benefits, but it continues to identify that as an important part of the discussion. I would ask the maker of the amendment, again, I do like this amendment. There could also be a current ongoing project in the area. It could be a dock. They're building a dock. It could be a harbor project. It could be something important to that community. So if after community we added and current or foreseeable projects, it would cover, again, just a general description of anything they were aware of that was ongoing. So it would read, including any impacts on cultural and subsistence uses and any anticipated costs and benefits to the community and current or foreseeable projects. It seems like if there was something ongoing, it would be a natural part of the discussion that it would come up, but we're not asking them to do an analysis in the sense. I appreciate it's more of a description of what we're aware of. I think that would be more fully inclusive of that, but I would just offer that for consideration.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. Appreciate that feedback. I think we have just got Marie Marks on the line. And so, Ms. Marks?
Yes, for the record, this is Marie Marks with Legislative Legal Services. I understand there was a question for me, Chair Tarr, and I believe it was on Amendment 10 that you're discussing on page 4, line 8.
Yes.
Deletion of E and F and replacing with E.
Yes, and just wanting to understand, is that conforming or was there some substantive change that occurs through that deletion of F?
It's a conforming change just because of the restructuring that was done. As things are added to the paragraphs and subparagraphs, it gets a little bit difficult to read cleanly, and so some restructuring, just reorganizing was done to make it read a little bit cleaner, and so no, it's not a substantive change. It's just because the previous language in subsection F was changed, and so subsection F no longer talks about a decision, a recommendation, specifically making that recommendation. That has been moved into, you can see on where it says page 3, lines 7 to 17, paragraph 2B, subparagraph B.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hopkins has a question.
Thank you, and thank you, Ms. Marks, for jumping on the phone with us here to help us do this. I understand where you're coming from, and I understand that F, the entire paragraph is changing. Under current G on page 4, line 8 through 11, it talks about what shall not constitute a final agency act decision or action, and the recommendation or action is not subject to appeal, including appeal or review under AS 4462. What would this amendment 10 that we're discussing,
What would and would not be a final agency action, or agency decision or action under this section? How does that change what is or is not appealable under AS 4462?
Through the chair, Representative, it would not make any substantive change. It would still be a recommendation or action of the commission under E, which is now we moved that language to E2B. Under E does not constitute a final agency decision or action, and the recommendation or action is not subject to appeal. So it would not change substantively that directive.
So follow up. Mm-hmm. The where it says F currently on line 8, page 4, dealing with the recommendation, we're eliminating any mention of the recommendation being any type of final agency decision or action, correct?
Through the chair, just to clarify, we are deleting the reference to subsection F because we took out language in subsection F that talked about how a recommendation is made by the commission. Because we changed subsection F, we no longer need to refer to it when the legislature says that a recommendation does not constitute a final agency decision. Reference to F, if Amendment 10 is adopted, would not make sense any longer.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if the question's for the bill sponsor or for Randy Bates, because I know that Randy was at the very end of one of our meetings. I'm looking at my notes, and my notes kind of drift a little bit. So on a Tier 3 designation, because we're looking at if there's a bridge or a port already in process of being developed, my notes said here that that the Tier 3 requires the water to be preserved in its current status. It could actually be improved also. Is that correct? I mean, is there a range in the status, or is it can't go below the current status but can be improved upon?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck. So Tier 3, the baseline data has to be kept intact. Like we said earlier, Tier 2 is Tier 3 with an escape valve where you're allowed variation within a period of time before you have to go back. So it is a higher standard even for an approved project. If something is already ongoing, DEC previously testified, if it's an ongoing, let's say it's already in place, then something that's in place is allowed to continue. Did I get that right? Yeah. Grandfathered in, correct. So where a look at a current or a foreseeable project, let's say it's not in place, but you're building an access road to a part of your community. Maybe you don't have access to your port you're trying to put in, or you're trying to put in a port or a dock or some community infrastructure that's not in place yet, but it's foreseeable, you're definitely working on it, or it's a current project ongoing. So that is why I just offered that to, if someone is aware of something like that, that could impact the cost of that project even going forward, that is maybe integral to that community's development plan, that at least it be brought up for discussion.
Okay, and if I may, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. I do have my notes that Tier 1 is, that's where not all water quality is being met, whether natural, existing, or done by humans. And then Tier 2 is a higher quality, but all quantities are being met. And then Tier 3 is required to reserve in current status. And then I also have in here that development can happen as long as there's no addition. And then this is where I'm getting confused. And I wrote down no additional water quality. And I don't know when I wrote that down, if I understood it that you don't have to put, if you designate Tier 3, there is no requirement to make the water better. You can stay at the baseline, right? So I'm understanding that correctly. Okay. All right. Thank you for the clarification. I appreciate it.
Representative Lincoln.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know. It might be helpful to point out that some Tier 3 water designations, such as one of them in California, the reason there was a Mono Lake, the reason it was deemed a Tier 3 water body was because the quality of that water was so rare, and that it was, I think, 10 times the salinity of the ocean, and a pH level of 10, I think. So it's not the type of water that we would consider like good water or clean water or any water that we'd want to drink. But there would be no discharge allowed that would change the quality of the water, like the features of that water, not necessarily quality from a human drinking perspective.
I see. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And can I ask one other question?
Mm-hmm.
So up at Red Dog Mine, there was, I thought it was called Fish Creek, but there was no fish in the creek. And then through proper mining in that area, the zinc concentrations were actually reduced. And now we have record trout and everything going up into that stream. So if there is a Tier 3 water designation, in the example that I'm hearing from California, where we've had certain levels that weren't necessarily ideal for human consumption, but there is if that happened to be a Tier 3 water body, would it have been in violation to have made that creek more livable or more habitable for fish?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, so if it degraded the water quality, yes, but a Tier 3, you can improve the water quality. So if the water quality is improved, you're not in violation of Tier 3. Maybe we need DEC to give a more, but I think you're giving a great example of improving the quality of a water body to the point where it had a thriving trout, possibly a salmon, I'm not sure, just grayling trout. So great example of industry doing the right thing. Yeah, it's a wonderful example. But I don't know that Tier 3 would have prevented that from happening, because it sounds like they're improving it. And the DEC did previously testify that if you're improving water quality, that's acceptable. Okay. Yeah.
And if I may, Madam Chair, just mm-hmm. as Co-Chair Lincoln, so when you were saying that the pH levels, and I don't know water quality levels of anything, but you said a pH level of 10, selenic or very high in saline, more so than oceans, is that a desirable feature, or is that just a unique feature that they wanted to preserve?
Yeah, I don't. I guess it depends on what your desires are. I guess it was unique and mm-hmm. interesting, and a water body or an environment on the planet that was rare, and you know, California's decided that it was worth protecting and not changing the qualities of that water. But it's not something that I think any of us would want to swim in or drink. So, and the
but there was also no. Sorry, if I may. Through the chair, so there was no desire to clean it up either. It was just like, leave it like it is, kind of cool.
I assume so, given their actions.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I wonder if Mr. Bates could come join us, because I don't want us to get past this point if we have any lack of clarity or misunderstandings on it.
Madam Chair, for the record, Randy Bates, Director of Water. The original question was, I believe, do we manage for improved water quality in a Tier 3 water body? Absolutely. We would love to see that water quality improved. We only would disallow an activity that in a Tier 3 water body if it degraded the current water quality standard. Okay. I think the question that Representative Tuck raised regarding Red Dog or any other project that is currently cleaning up existing water and releasing it in a better form than it came into their facility, it's a good question. I have a question into my staff already. I was hoping to get an answer back through the wonders of texting before I came up here. But we'll have an answer back for you as well on that one.
Thank you.
Okay, I appreciate that. And I can see there's other questions, so if you don't mind staying here. Representative Rauscher.
So through the chair, I guess bouncing off of what Representative Tuck has said, then abstractly talking here, if you have a body of water with 10 pollutants, things grandfathered in to pollute it, and 9 of them clean up their act, can the 12th one come in and pollute it back to where it was when it was designated?
Mm-hmm.
Would
Representative, I'm sorry. I was listening. I just didn't quite get the full question. Could you repeat it?
Representative Rush, would you mind repeating?
Madam Chair, I think I can help.
Well, I just want to make sure we get, as the member of the committee, get his question out there. Yeah, just to, yes.
I guess what I'm saying is you're talking about a certain level, and you want to maintain that level or clean it up. But yet, if a certain amount of factories are now cleaning up their own act on their own, and the entire water body, whether it be a large lake or whatever, has now the overall testing of the water has improved a lot. Can the newcomer come in and basically bring it back to the standard of where it was when it was designated, which would be actually to degrade the water?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair. Yes. Okay. If a Tier 3 water body is established and we take a look at what the existing quality of the water is, just as an example, if it's for one parameter out of the 12, it's at 10, which is the limit, that's where it's at. So that's what it's established under Tier 3, 4. Any project that comes in that might degrade that water quality and add any additional degradation to take that water parameter above that level to 11, that's disallowed. That would not be an allowable activity.
Does that answer your
question? So I don't think the question was answered.
And Madam Chair, if I could take a stab at it.
Okay, sure. This, for the record, is Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Chuck Kopp. So, Representative Rauscher, what I heard you say is you have 12 pollutants, and you get 11 of them to go away. Can you take the 12th pollutant, and are you allowed to
muddy it up,
overcharge it, yeah, and get back up to what the total of the 12 did before? And I would say, Madam Chair, no, because there's a baseline established for each one of the pollutants individually, and I think if you supercharged one pollutant, you're exceeding the baseline. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's my understanding as well.
Okay, that was Mr. Randy Bates.
That was Randy Bates.
Just so that she can have that. Representative Rauscher, do you have any additional comment on that?
Since I can't disprove or prove any of it, I am accepting the answer. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hannon.
Although, Madam Chair, what I was hearing Representative Rauscher say wasn't pollutants, but polluters.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of saying they cleaned up 11 measurable compounds, I heard him asking, you had 12 polluters, and 11 of them went out of business, and one person's left. They've cleaned up their water. They are no longer polluting. Could polluter number 12 now exceed and fill that whole pollutant plume because there's only one polluter left?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, either way, I guess. Mm-hmm. Her scenario is different, mm-hmm. but I think her question is the same,
mm-hmm.
if you understand what mm-hmm. I'm saying.
Well, and maybe Mr. Bates sounded like you were looking into this, and maybe you could also provide some clarity on that. After one of our earlier meetings, we did go back and look and found that, for example, if you had a proposed activity upriver from a Tier 3 designation, but that the mixing zone kind of concept using that by the time it got to the section where it was Tier 3, that upriver activity would not be disallowed, but it couldn't disrupt the water quality of the Tier 3 section. So in that sense, it's a little bit like what you're asking, that you know, this was set here and, you know, there's could be this other sort of outlier also influencing that, but I think yours was a little more specific to the actual Tier 3, not something happening, you know, upriver outside of the Tier 3. So, you know, I think the question is, as established, a Tier 3 sets a standard, you know, if the operators, if you will, in that area change, you know, what does that mean for the water quality standard that was established when it became a Tier 3 relative to new applicants for discharges into that Tier 3 water? If we could get because I think we're going to be out of time, and it sounds like you might need to check with a staff person to kind of get that clarity, is what I was hearing, Mr. Bates.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm happy to get back with you, as we did at the last one, Representative.
Okay, and Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Representative Tarp. My question is actually for Marie Marks on that subparagraph G on page 4, if she's still there.
Okay, and if we can have folks, if they can hold on for one more minute here. I think we have maybe a minute or two to go over, but we have LNC at 3:15. Ms. Marks, are you available?
I am. Again, for the record, this is Marie Marks with Legislative Legal Services. Happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay, Representative Hannon.
So my question, and I had not paid close enough attention to subparagraph G previously, but when we're looking at that language, line 9, does not constitute a final agency decision or action, line 10. So the action is not subject to appeal, including appeal or review, and then it cites regulation. Is that because the action of the commission still has to go through a legislative process, and that would be deemed the way to appeal it, or is the standard language? It seemed to me that if they made a decision but it's not appealable, we were truncating a public process, but I don't know enough about it.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, again for the record, Marie Marks with Legislative Legal Services. Generally, advisory bodies, and these are bodies who make purely advisory recommendations, that issue recommendations, generally, and I looked into this and I could not find a recommendation of a purely advisory body that was subject to appeal or review. And I think that this is because the recommendations of purely advisory boards or commissions, they're not enforceable against the public, Representative Hannon, as you mentioned, in a meaningful way, until they're implemented by further agency or legislative action. And therefore, they really don't govern the conduct or the rights of the public. That said, you know, it's a policy decision on what kind of directive the legislature would like to include. And here, you know, we draft by request. And so the directive here is that a recommendation of this agency is not subject to appeal or review, and that is consistent again when I looked into the issue. I again could not find a purely advisory body's recommendation being subject to appeal or review, because again, it needs further action either by the agency or by the legislature.
Okay. Now, where we're at right now, we discussed Amendment Number 5, and then it was withdrawn, and now we're on Amendment Number 10 because it's closely related. I am comfortable withdrawing my objection at this time to adopt Amendment Number 10. Is there another objection to that amendment? Okay, so we will adopt Number 10. If I could ask members then for the continuation, we have this bill up on Wednesday. Then we will go to 13 and 14 afterwards, because it's also closely related to that. And then we will come back and finish the last few in the stack. We also have House Bill 151 before the committee. And I believe the amendment deadline, I'm trying to look to announce it, has been noticed. And so it should be tomorrow. Yes, thank you. 1 p.m. tomorrow. I just want to make sure we didn't do anything different. So amendment deadline for House Bill 151 tomorrow at 1 p.m. We'll hope to take that up and move that bill through if it's the will of the committee on Wednesday. And then we will continue the amendments for this bill on Wednesday. If there's no other business to come before the committee, we will adjourn at 3:04 p.m. today. Thank you, everyone, for your patience in this process.